This is On Shifting Ground. By now, maybe you've had a chance to sneak away during holiday gatherings or slip into the sports bar during your lunch break to catch the most entertaining results from the World Cup in Qatar.
One of the biggest upsets in World Cup history. 2-1, Saudi Arabia has defeated heavily favored
Japan have defeated Germany.
Despite the drama on the field, it's been impossible to ignore the political turmoil off of it. From a bought bid to massive labor and human rights abuses, not to mention player protests and a ledger exceeding $220 billion.
Allison, by some estimates, the cost of the Qatar Games is higher than all of the past World Cup tournaments put together.
It's hard not to ask, what's really going on in Qatar? This week, we set out to answer that question. In 2015, Alex K. Jelski was the first out gay man to become a national sports editor in the UK. Now, Alex is the editor-in-chief of The Athletic's UK newsroom, where he oversees a lot of the soccer coverage. When I spoke with Alex November 28th, he was still grappling with how to cover an event whose host country criminalizes his own sexual identity, and frankly, how to enjoy the world's biggest and arguably most controversial sporting event. Alex K. Jelski, welcome to On Shifting Ground.
Hey, thank you for having me.
At one point you asked, should we even send reporters to Qatar? Was that ever a serious possibility in real life?
Well, the conversation was real. We had a chat because we didn't feel very comfortable about lots of elements of the World Cup. We knew that we have a soul and a heart as a business, and we wanted to think about what was the best way that we could do something that mattered. And we talked about, should we send? We talked about, should we ban the word Qatar from all our coverage because that would sort of stop any sports washing of that name being normalized around some of the great moments. And we kind of went back and forth on various things, lots. And in the end, we basically decided we were just going to keep writing and writing and writing and uncovering as many things as we could so that people realize this is not just about people scoring goals and winning the World Cup. It's about some pretty awful things that happened and continue to happen.
You're the editor. You had to decide, as was apparent in your answer, not only whether to cover, but how to cover this thing. What did you have to consider?
We certainly sent some specialists who I thought would be really good at digging and investigating into things outside of the stadiums. And we did things before as well. Like we had a writer who we sent to Nepal in the weeks leading up to the tournament to speak to the people who built the stadiums and to the families who lost people who built the stadiums, for example. So I think it's not just about what happens during, but what happened before. And I think crucially, what's going to happen afterwards? Like what's going to happen to all the people left behind?
Awarding the World Cup to Qatar has been contentious and controversial since the very beginning, back in 2010, when the first release of the schedule came and basically football people said, what? We're going to stop in the middle of a season, go play the World Cup, and then carry on again? This seemed so unlikely, and yet FIFA, the world body, affirmed it. And everybody rolled forward with it. And now, 12 years later, here we are. How's it working out?
Well, I can't get that worked up about the stopping the season in the middle and playing it. I mean, you couldn't have held it there in the middle of summer. It would have been unbearable temperature-wise. So I think by the time you decided to hold it in Qatar, you're going to have to host it in the winter. That stuff bothers me less, I think. The workers' rights, the human rights, the women's rights, the LGBT rights, everything around that. I actually think that's been worse than I thought at this World Cup. I thought that everyone would turn a blind eye and it would all be all right, but that certainly hasn't been the case, especially, for example, FIFA, in theory, preventing a group of nations from wearing what they call the One Love armband. So there's a group of countries, including England, the Netherlands and Germany, who decided, rightly or wrongly, that their protest against the lack of LGBT rights in Qatar was to wear an armband that said One Love on it. And I wasn't the biggest fan of that as a gay man. It didn't say LGBT anywhere in the press release. It wasn't the pride rainbow. It was like in a strange constructed rainbow. But they felt it would make a statement. I was less sure. A few days before the World Cup and the first games, FIFA said they couldn't wear it. And if they wore it, then the captains who wore these armbands would get yellow cards. And the countries all backed down. So they'd made this promise for quite a while. And all of a sudden, they didn't do it, which I thought was pretty weak and pretty pathetic. Some people have done things since. So the Germans made a gesture just ahead of their first game where they put their hands over their mouths in the team photo to say that they'd been silenced, which was really good because it continued the conversation. Denmark have talked about withdrawing from FIFA in protest. And then others, England, Netherlands, Wales, have just done nothing. The contempt, I think, from the countries and from FIFA for LGBT fans, it is just, I don't know, incredibly depressing, heartbreaking, really. I mean, it's basically got to the point where we don't matter. And I think that's pretty clear. People, the funny thing with all these issues is people can put all the sort of statements they want out in the years leading up to something. And then when it comes to it, what do? Nothing that matters.
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on here. I mean, German fans would be pretty disappointed if they started every game with a yellow card, and it would actually change the nature of the competition in a way that probably many would applaud and many would deplore. At the same time, you're covering sport for your readers. Are you still gauging? Do football fans, are you sure your readers accept from the beginning the proposition that all these other angles have to be covered along with the sport? For instance, how much attention do you give to Iranian players not singing the national anthem in sympathy with the women of their country before the game versus their drubbing by England and everything that follows from that?
The answer is you do both. And I think that's really important. Like, you can't force people to care about certain elements. And some people want to read about the politics around this World Cup. Some people just want to read about the football, and that's okay, right? I think we're there to present all the options. So, yeah, we've written pieces about how Lionel Messi, at the absolute key moment, came to Argentina's rescue when they could have gone out the World Cup. We also wrote, which has been our most popular piece of the whole World Cup so far, about how Lionel Messi is taking money from the Saudi government to help promote their country. So those are two different types of articles. Some people might like both. Some people might like one. That's okay.
There was a lot of back and forth about the sale of beer at the football venues. At one point, they were going to sell it in the suites, but not in the stands, then not at all. For no small number of fans, it must be hard to imagine watching the game without a beer. Is this a big deal? Not a big deal? Where does it rank in the cavalcade of big deals that's been rolling out of Qatar?
I think the actual beer part is quite low down that list. I think the important part of it is the fact that they just changed their rules and their minds the day before the World Cup started, right? You win a bid based on a list of criteria. And I think that's what's bad about it. There were lots of assurances made, for example, over more serious things like human rights and LGBT rights and women's rights. And if all of a sudden there's a U-turn over something as silly as and small as beer, what else might there be a U-turn on? I think that was the concern there. I mean, yeah, some people enjoy drinking beer at football matches. Some people don't, right? There's plenty of people at that World Cup who are just happy to go along and, okay, maybe it won't go down as the beeriest World Cup, but I think we'll all get over that. And I think if that becomes too much of a focus, then it does take away from the more serious issues anyway.
As you've mentioned, you're a gay man. You've written in the past about how that is sometimes an unusual thing to be in your world, the world of sports journalism. Qatar has been particularly pointed about its unwillingness to allow any shows of support for gay rights in a country that is particularly hard on sexual minorities. I saw a photo of one fan with a rainbow on a T-shirt the shirt had a whole other context. It had nothing to do with LGBTQ rights. It just had a rainbow on it, and he was refused entry into the stadium. They told him to go somewhere and change his shirt, and then they'd let him in. I'm at a loss sometimes to explain the pettiness. I mean, maybe a camera would find you somewhere or someone would see you in the stands in the shirt, but going to that level to police the crowd seems to be something the Qataris were willing to do.
Well, because that's what they believe, right? They have their culture, their interpretation of their religion. They believe that people like myself shouldn't be able to live in the way that I can in the UK, right? And yeah, that's incredibly hurtful and horrible. Of course, I can't get my head around it. I also know that maybe things do take time. Maybe the exposure will help over the next few decades. Like, it's not like the UK or the US or other countries have been perfect places or are perfect places for a long time. There's plenty of other places in the West that I wouldn't go and walk around holding my husband's hand or anything like that. So I think we have to be a little bit careful at just saying, it's Qatar. Like, it's far more complex than that. That doesn't mean that it's something to feel happy about.
Should it have precluded the country winning the bid?
It's really complicated, isn't it? I mean, my every instinct in me says, yeah, of course. But where do we then stop, right? Do we have issues over Roe v. Wade and abortion rights with the US hosting the 2026 World Cup? I don't know. Like, what are the rights and rules that we think allows a country to host a World Cup and the ones that don't? How many countries, if we had to make a list of the pure countries whose laws and morals we think we agree with, like, how long is that list actually when you dig down? It's really, really gray area and very, very complicated.
Well, now that all that's out of the way, let's talk about the sport. How are these international players handling leaving their club sides in the middle of the season, heading to the Gulf and playing these crucial games? Have there been any standout matches that you would take an American who's only a casual follower of the game and say, here, watch this. This is why we love this sport.
Yeah, I think there were two like really big surprises that were amazing. So I think Saudi Arabia beating Argentina and Japan beating Germany, like these two giants of soccer, like two of the most successful teams in history, losing games in unthinkable manners. I mean, that was incredibly exciting. There's been some really amazing individual performances. I mean, people should go and just find an opportunity to watch Kylian Mbappe, who plays for France. France are the world champions, and he is just so talented and fast and clever and brilliant. And then people should definitely tap into the Cristiano Ronaldo storyline. So for those who don't know, Cristiano Ronaldo, like one of the best players of all time as well, he just got let go by his club, Manchester United, for giving an unsolicited television interview in which he criticized everybody there, including the people who own the club. And they just didn't want him anymore. So they've got rid of him. And he's wandering around the World Cup, leading his Portugal team, with no team to go home to. So it's a really extraordinary situation. And the guy is, well, he loves himself, put it that way. So it's never dull.
You know, Alex, I've been doing World Cup stories for 30 years. And they always, because I've been doing them based in the United States, they always have this sort of Flying Dutchman, Moby Dick, Great White Whale thing, like off in the future, here comes the giant, sleeping giant awakens. Yes, American fans are finally going to like soccer. The U.S. men's team is finally going to arrive and show the United States as a powerhouse. And it never quite happens. What are reasonable expectations for a country that has always been sort of on the edge of really embracing this game? There have been games with big television numbers in the United States. There have been occasional flashes of brilliance and flashes of public interest, a whole generation of kids that's grown up playing the sport. I wonder what the rest of the world, casting its eyes across the Atlantic or the Pacific, depending on where you are, makes of America when it comes to football, when it comes to soccer.
Well, and also doing that in the shadow of the women's team who are just so brilliant and so successful, right? I think they're a very different proposition now. My opinion previously was that the US often had functional teams with good attitudes who would find a way as an underdog to kind of get some results over a line. I think they are a much more technically proficient team now. I think this group of young players who are playing in some of the leading leagues in Europe are just better footballers. That doesn't mean that things happen overnight, but I do think the gap between them and some of the other leading countries is getting smaller, just maybe not as fast as people want, you know. Maybe in another 4 years, they're a bit more capable of a couple more upsets. Maybe they're not. But I imagine everyone should be focusing on a home World Cup in 2026 and thinking, right, good team, home audience, like that should surely be the next level of breakthrough moment.
Will FIFA get a second look now? Has all this caused at least national federations to say, well, yeah, I mean, everybody's talking about bribery and corruption and flaws in the decision-making process and the guys at the top. Maybe it's time to really clean house. Or, as you mentioned, with sport washing, if it ends up being a great final, exciting, well-rated, does FIFA get to, live on that oxygen for a while and not have a reckoning?
FIFA won't have a reckoning. Don't forget that when all the arrests were made, many years ago now, near the end of the Sepp Blatter era, that the day the arrests were made...
Now, despite being almost the dictionary definition of corruption, they've escaped any significant prosecution for decades. But that all ended on Wednesday.
High-ranking officials from FIFA, the sport's governing body, arrested in an overnight raid in Switzerland, the result of a sweeping FBI investigation.
Blatter was re-elected as FIFA president by a landslide, right? Like, FIFA just feel, even after everything, to me, incredibly bulletproof.
So even this, I mean, I'm not a student of the sport like you are, but it seems to me that we've been talking about this World Cup for a dozen years now, just because it's so out there in so many ways. Even with this, bulletproof is the word you'd use.
Well, I just think that the people who were involved in corruption, the people who voted for this, like, they're not there generally anymore, right? A lot of them are in jail. Some of them are dead. Like, the current regime will just say, well, yeah, well, we didn't vote this, right? Well, the vote that they overseen was USA, Canada, Mexico, 2026. Well, it'll be really interesting to see who wins the 2030 World Cup bid, because very strong chance that that's heading to Saudi Arabia.
Well, let's talk some more about that, because there's a hardening list of countries that are willing to vie for these things, and they're so expensive, and they require money that in some places just gets conjured up, as with the Sochi Olympics and the Beijing Olympics. Are normal countries going to be able to bid for these things? Several countries have pulled their bids for both the Winter and Summer Olympics because the numbers just got too stratospheric and they said, no, we're out. And it just seems like something that Kazakhstan can do, but South Korea can't.
Yeah, look, it is expensive. There's no hiding that. I think when you look at the likely bids for 2030, like, there's still some hope there. So you've got this joint South America bid, which I think is Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay. Like, you know, those are countries that certainly mostly that you associate with football. We've then got the weird sort of joint bid with Saudi and Greece, which is a very strange bedfellow. Spain and Portugal and Ukraine are trying to win it together. I think that's highly unlikely. And we'll see who else emerges. So look, yes, having lots and lots of money to spend on this helps, right? And the same with Olympics. Olympics have become incredibly difficult to host, especially because you're left with all this infrastructure afterwards from these things, right? I was thinking the other day, like, what on earth's going to happen to these Doha stadiums? But I don't know. I think the next European Championships in France, the next World Cups in USA, Mexico and Canada, like, there's a Women's World Cup coming up in Australia and New Zealand. I don't think we're at the stage yet where we need to completely worry about that.
These joint bids are interesting because they almost concede that the thing itself has become so huge that it can be shared by a region of the planet instead of just one national federation.
Yeah, and the cost, right? And also the World Cup, the Men's World Cup, is about to go up in the number of teams. It's just too many games and too much cost. So again, that makes a lot of sense.
With all that we've discussed, are you having fun? Is this too complicated? Are the moral dilemmas too real for you to finally just revert to being a football fan and have a little fun while you're doing this?
I'm having loads of fun, and in two ways. I mean, firstly, there are some genuine football things and moments that are great. And also, you know, we've got more stories coming out about human rights and things, and I enjoy getting stuck into them. I enjoy keeping the promise that we said we're going to investigate things and sharing that with the world. I think that's okay.
Fair enough. Alex Kajelski is the editor of The Athletic UK. It's been great to have you. Thanks a lot.
No, absolute pleasure. I hope it was of some interest and use.
You're listening to On Shifting Ground. I'm Ray Suarez. After the break, we'll hear from economist Andrew Zimbalist about why hosting a World Cup may not be worth the price of admission. If you missed any part of this episode or want to catch up on other international stories, download our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Despite its overflowing coffers, it's probably fair to guess FIFA has some regrets about awarding the 2022 World Cup to Qatar. Since 2010, the tournament has been a public relations nightmare with absurd storylines that sound like fiction. But based on economist Andrew Zimbalist's estimates, the biggest regret may reside with the host country itself. I talked with Professor Zimbalist about how much the 2022 World Cup might actually end up costing Qatar. Andrew Zimbalist, welcome to On Shifting Ground.
Thank you, Ray. Good to be with you.
It's been reported that Qatar spent more than $200 billion preparing to host the 2022 World Cup. That's a lot of money. Where did it go?
It went all over the place. Part of it, and we don't have exact numbers. Different media reports are coming out with different numbers, but it seems that somewhere north of $10 billion was spent on building from scratch seven new stadiums with between 40,000 capacity and 88,000 capacity. One stadium was renovated, but substantially renovated. So somewhere north of $10 billion was spent on the soccer facilities themselves. Beyond that, they reportedly spent $36 billion on their Doha metro system that they've installed over the last 12 years. And they spent $16 billion on building a new airport rather than renovating or expanding the existing airport. That gives you an indication that a lot of the spending was on related infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, communications infrastructure. The most commonly cited number is $220 billion. Bloomberg, which usually does careful jobs with statistics of this sort, estimated the total at $300 billion. This number, Ray, is well above, take the 220 because that's the most commonly cited, that's well above the GDP of Qatar, which last year was $180 billion. So it's 22% above the GDP. And they spent that amount of money, of course, over 12 years because the games were awarded to Qatar in 2010. So roughly they've been spending $18.3 billion a year for the last 12 years. That's a little over 10% of their GDP each year. That would be the equivalent of the United States spending $2.3 trillion a year for 12 years. So it's an enormous amount of money. It's an enormous commitment. It's well, well above the spending for any other sports mega event in the history of the world. Previous records were set by Sochi for the 2014 Winter Olympics. which was somewhere between $50 billion and $65 billion that was spent. The largest previous number for the World Cup, well, actually there are two numbers, and neither is precise, but the estimates are that both in Russia in 2018 and in Brazil in 2014, somewhere in the neighborhood of $18 to $20 billion was spent in each of those. So you're looking at a number that's, you know, roughly 10 times, maybe a little bit more than 10 times, the previous record spending for hosting the World Cup. And of course, the issues with Qatar are manifold, but one of the chief issues is that the citizenship in Qatar is 300,000 people, and it doesn't have a soccer tradition or professional soccer league. And that meant that there was no reason for them to have any of these stadiums beforehand. And there's equally no reason for them to have these stadiums afterwards. A stadium that wasn't economically viable to support at the beginning of 2022 is not going to be economically viable to support afterwards. But they'll nonetheless have approximately six stadiums that will not be accounted for. Two stadiums are going to be, as I understand it, disassembled and sent elsewhere in the world. That, of course, will cost some extra money to do that, but at least those stadiums will be cleared away and the land will become available. Six of the other stadiums will just be there. One of them, the largest stadium, the 88,000 one, they're saying they're going to repurpose it for multi-use, but it's the plan there is unclear.
You've already given us the beginnings of an idea of how economists do the ledger on a project like this. I think it's fair to say there's no need to set up a GoFundMe page for Qatar. It's sitting on an enormous bottomless lake of fossil fuels. But how should an economist, how should a Qatari for that matter, figure out whether that was money or what part of it was money well spent? When you pull out the yellow legal size pad and you start jotting down figures on the two sides of the ledger, are those the things like, well, you name the subway system. That would seem to be something that's a net good and it doesn't go away after the football fans leave.
Correct. There's a qualifier, though. I think that your instinct is right about the subway system. The qualifier is, and one would have to make a detailed study of this, and I certainly have not done that in Northampton, Massachusetts so far. But if the metro is connecting stadiums together, the eight stadiums, rather than connecting residential neighborhoods with the downtown area where people go to work, then some of the investment in the metro of the $36 billion spent on the metro, some of it is not conducive to the long-term development needs of Doha and Qatar. If, on the other hand, the metro lines are ignoring the location of the stadiums and they're based on some careful study of the needs of Qatari development, then maybe you could say most of that $36 billion is appropriate for investment and the development needs of the country. So one would have to go and look at the different kinds of expenditures. Same thing with the airport, $16 billion, new airport. Why not renovate or expand the old airport? Was it because they were looking for glitz and beauty for the 30 days of the World Cup, or is it because this new airport was actually needed? Now, oddly enough, some of the reason they needed an expanded airport is because a lot of the people who are coming to watch the games can't find accommodation in Doha. There's simply not enough accommodation. And so people are flying in from Saudi Arabia. It's just a 30 or 40 minute flight from most of the Saudi airports anyway. But similarly, with other Gulf states, people are flying in because there's not sufficient hotel rooms to accommodate them. And in that case, to the extent that they expanded the airport to deal with the extra flights, dozens of flights that are coming in and out every day, then that's not an appropriate meeting of the needs of long-term development for Doha and Qatar. So again, one would have to look at that $220 billion plus of infrastructure investment and piece by piece saying, was this a priority investment? If in the year 2010, some rational planning had been done for the development of Qatar, what would be prioritized? Would the expansion of the airport for $16 billion be prioritized, or were there other needs, such as, for instance, providing health and safety and decent wage, living wages for their migrant workers? When you provide decent wages and provide other benefits for your workforce, they have more income and the domestic market develops. And it has all sorts of ramifications for what kinds of investments are needed for future development.
You mentioned 300,000 Qatari citizens. There are also about seven times as many expats and guest workers living there on a sort of permanent rotating basis. So this is a country with about as many residents as Brooklyn. Has a place that small ever held a major international sporting event like this one?
No, it's never happened before. And, you know, oddly, when you're doing this for an international monopoly like FIFA, and FIFA is accustomed to certain standards being met, then you really have to stretch yourself to accommodate what FIFA demands. Why do you need eight stadiums, for instance? Well, the reason it's happening, of course, is that FIFA has a lot of bargaining power and they like a lot of glitz. But you don't need eight stadiums to host the World Cup. Over the 30 days of the World Cup, there are 64 games played. 64 total games will be played. Over 30 days, that's 2.1 games per day. It might be a little radical to suggest that you could do all of that in one stadium. But if you can't do it in one, you could do it in two or three at the most. But FIFA comes along and says you have to have eight. And of the eight, one has to have 80,000 capacity for the championship game, and one has to have 60,000 capacity for the initial game, the opening game, and all the others have to have at least 40,000 capacity. By the way, in addition to the stadiums themselves, you have the practice fields galore. And every time you have a stadium, of course, you need parking lots and other facilities in order to make the games possible. So each one of these stadiums is an enormous investment. And then on top of that, you've got to have the infrastructure to connect the stadium, the transportation infrastructure, and you need a communications infrastructure. You need hospitality. Reportedly, Ray, they built somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 new hotels for the World Cup. Now, those hotels will be filled during the days of the World Cup. At least most of them will be mostly filled. But what happens when the World Cup is over? You have a surplus of hotel rooms. And this is not unique to Qatar for sport mega events. Hospitality investments basically go to waste afterwards. You've way overbuilt for the demand for the services.
Well, looking at recent host cities for major games, semifinal, final, opening day, is Doha like Cape Town, like Rio, like Seoul or Berlin? Is someone going to decide to visit Qatar on the strength of what they see while watching the World Cup on TV? Is there some useful and quantifiable raising of the country's worldwide profile that comes from this?
Well, this is the argument, I think, Ray. You know, when you point out that on the one hand, Qatar is spending somewhere between $200 and $300 billion to host these games. And on the other hand, what do they get in terms of revenue? Concretely, what do they get back? Well, FIFA takes all of the revenue from international television money, which is about $2.64 billion. FIFA takes all of the money from international marketing and sponsorship rights, which is about $1.4 billion. FIFA takes all of the money from ticket sales and hospitality rights, which is about $0.7 billion. FIFA gets all of that. Qatar doesn't get any of that. So what does Qatar get? Well, they're estimating that there'll be approximately 1 million visitors. Some of the estimates are slightly higher, up to 1.3 million. And if each of those residents stays in the country for 4 days on average and spends on average $300 a day, and if no normal business travelers or tourist travelers are deterred from going to the games to avoid the commotion and the traffic and the high prices and so on, then you've got approximately, under those assumptions, you've got $1.6 billion of revenue coming in. So what kind of a balance sheet is that? On one side of the balance sheet, there's an expenditure of $200 to $300 billion. On the other side, there's increased revenue, conservatively and favorably judged at $1.6 billion. That's terrible. You don't make an investment where you invest 200 and you get back one or two. So the argument is, and this goes now to your question more specifically, the argument is, well, there's an enormous benefit in soft power that justifies that imbalance between expenditures and revenues. The soft power being that now Qatar has put itself on the world stage. It showed the rest of the world how much money it has, how much glitz it has, how it can carry out an event like this, they hope, effectively. And as a result, Qatar will have more influence in the Middle East. It will have more influence in the world, and it will all be worth it at the end of the day. Well, first of all, from other sports mega events, there's very little evidence, and certainly no hard evidence of growing soft power. Part of the problem is that when you put yourself on the proverbial world stage, it's a two-way street. Yes, you'll have perhaps 4 billion, perhaps 5 billion individuals watching at least some moments of the World Cup on television. And so, yes, there is some exposure to your country when you're hosting the games. But there's also a lot of bad news about Qatar that you and I have and that people around the world have that they didn't have before. We learned about, if we didn't know already about it, we learned about the grotesque kafala labor system and the gross mistreatment of workers. We learned about also the gross mistreatment of the LGBTQ community and of women more generally. We learned about the repression of journalists in Qatar. We learned about not fulfilling their contracts to Anheuser-Busch, about allowing beer to be sold in the stadiums. The only people who can drink alcohol are the people who are sitting in the executive suites. We learned that there's a betting handle, a gambling handle, that will exceed $35 billion, up over 65% from any of the previous game. There's a lot of bad stuff that's going on. We learned that there was corruption to get the games in the first place. They bought the games. They paid off a bunch of the people on the executive committee. The executive committee of some about 25 people, the Qataris were paying off some of the voters, many of the voters on the executive committee. The Qataris told France that they would buy several billion dollars of Airbus planes if they got the games. And so there's a lot of corruption at the very beginning that continued for many years afterwards. So the bad news goes on and on. And I think that that's been spread much more widely than any of the good news. And so the notion that there's much of a gain of soft power here, I think, is just not very persuasive at all. More likely than not, the image of Qatar has been tarnished. It has not been burnished.
Britain built an enormous complex south of the Thames River to host the Olympic Games. There was a lot of controversy around that. There was a lot of excitement and praise for the UK organizing committee as well after those games were over. But I think it's a mixed record for whether that stadium has paid off over time. I was in Las Vegas when they were hotly debating whether to move forward with trying to attract an NFL franchise and build a proper stadium there for Major League professional football. Are there any examples of places that Qatar can look to for a model for what to do in the years after everybody goes away? Countries that are thinking for bidding for these international sports extravaganzas can look to and say, maybe they did it right and these people overspent or undermanaged or made some bad decisions. Are there at least some actors in this space, the weird space that it is, who have transportable lessons to teach?
Well, I think so, but I'm not sure that they're lessons that Qatar could benefit from at this point. I mean, the last World Cup, I think that arguably made some sense, was relatively balanced in terms of expenditures and revenues, was Germany, 2006. Why was that more or less sensible and acceptable? Because soccer is a traditional sport. It's a massively popular sport in Germany. And they already had the 8 stadiums fitting the specifications that FIFA demanded. Germany obviously is a developed country, so it had a developed transportation infrastructure and communications infrastructure and a hospitality infrastructure. So the amount of money that had to be spent by Germany was very modest. You could look at Los Angeles for the Summer Olympics in 1984. And I think a similar situation will apply to them in 2028. Basically, they had all that they needed. So the amount of additional new investment was diminutive. Another case that I think was very successful, but it was loaded with special circumstances, was Barcelona, the Barcelona Olympics, Summer Olympics in 1992. Barcelona had replanned their economy in the late 70s after Franco died and democracy was being introduced. They had planning meetings and decided what they wanted to do with their city. that their city was shut off from the sea by a warehousing and factory district. And they decided to move it to another part of the city and to restructure the road system in Barcelona. And after they put in place a plan, they then decided that it would be a small additional investment, and in fact, an investment that would facilitate what they were planning to do anyway, to by the small additional investment would be investing in the Olympics. So in that case, they made the Olympics fit their plan rather than their city fitting the plan of the IOC or the plan of FIFA. And so it worked out pretty well. It just so happened to be the case that roughly at the same time, Spain entered the European common market. Spain made a very big investment in its tourism sector. And a number of other factors were propelling a positive outcome. So, yeah, I think that there are examples you could look at that have to do with planning, that have to do with the extent to which they already have the facilities and the infrastructure that's needed. And if you study those beforehand, you can make some rational choices about whether it makes sense in terms of economics, in terms of political soft power, to go forward with the games. But I think it's too late for Qatar at this point. They've excessively overspent. And the question about whether it was appropriate for a country of this size with their climate, by the way, the $10 billion stadium estimate is in part a function of the fact that they have to provide air conditioning in all the stadiums because of the heat. And these are outdoor stadiums. And apparently it doubled or tripled the cost of many of these facilities.
And the numbers that you mentioned about FIFA's take are just shocking. Could you imagine a point at which potential host cities might just say, or potential host nations might just say, forget it, we're out, we don't want to play. If these are the rules of the game, nobody can play.
Well, I don't think it's true that nobody can play. The United States is going to do it with Canada and Mexico in 2026, and the amount of new investments will be very, very small. And so certainly the United developed countries are in a position to do it. In the case of the Olympics, especially the Summer Olympics, which is much larger, you need 35 to 40 venues, sometimes even more than 40 sporting venues. Plus, you need the whole infrastructure. And you need an Olympic Village, which houses 17,000 people. And you need a media village. You need a lot more to do the Olympics. And there, what's happening is that cities are saying, no, we don't want it. Last five or six biddings for the Summer and the Winter Olympics, you started out with four or five different cities expressing an interest, and then citizens demanding a plebiscite and voting it down, or the city council voting it down. And so you end up with one or two potential hosts. It finally got so embarrassing for the IOC that they said, well, we're not going to have public bidding anymore. It's all going to be behind closed doors. In the case of FIFA, I think that if you look for countries that already have the sporting and transportation infrastructure, that it's still viable. And in terms of the self-dealing and the corruption, yes, it's been ever present. It's gotten worse and worse with FIFA. But look, FIFA depends on corporate sponsorships to a large degree. And if they continue to embarrass the sponsors like they have this year, especially with Anheuser-Busch, but with many others as well, and citizens and consumers start saying, well, we're not going to buy Coca-Cola anymore because they're associated with FIFA, then Coca-Cola is having a backwards investment when they sponsor FIFA. They want their investment, just like Qatar wanted its investment, to burnish its image, to promote its brand. And if FIFA generates enough negative publicity around the World Cup, then Coca-Cola becomes associated with that. Rather than it pushing sales, it deters its sales. And Coca-Cola will go back to FIFA, and I suspect Anheuser-Busch and other sponsors will go back and say, listen, this isn't working out for us anymore. You guys have to clean this up if you want our money. So I do think that the corporate sponsors will play a role, just like corporate sponsors are today playing a role in undermining Elon Musk and Twitter. You're existing in a world that has certain values, it has certain sense of ethics. And maybe you could flout that a little bit, but if you do it too much, you're going over the line and you're killing the goose that lays the golden eggs.
Apart from the well-documented and much talked about corruption, FIFA also has a role as a custodian of a global game, and they want to encourage its development in all kinds of places and continue to foster its reach in a lot of places. If you start to give the bids to just those places that can handle it, to avoid just what we're seeing now with Qatar? Do you end up just being in the global north, a joint bid between, as you mentioned, the United States, Canada, and Mexico? Germany, France is the host the next time out. If you want to have these events in places like South Africa, in places like Brazil, where, incidentally, they're football mad, do you have to help them out? Or what? I don't understand how to proceed on a sound business footing and on a sound ethical footing when you've got the high degree of income inequality that you have in the world, the hunger for the World Cup, and at the same time, an organization that's trying not to give every tournament to Paris, Berlin, and Chicago and Los Angeles.
Right. Well, a few thoughts here. Brazil is soccer mad, but it's soccer mad in certain parts of the country and less so in other parts. So they ended up building stadiums in places like Manaus and Brasilia, which have teams in the third and fourth division in the Brazilian soccer hierarchy, and get 1,000 people to the games. They built stadiums with 45,000 and 70,000 capacity. So there was a tremendous amount of waste in Brazil anyway. And there's a lesson there, I think. And you point out an important conflict or tension, which is that if FIFA behaves rationally on the one hand and says, here's country A, a developed country, they have the facilities already, so let's give it to them. And here's country B that doesn't have the facilities and it's a less developed country, so let's not give it to them. Then is it the case that the FIFA from now into eternity will always be hosted in the first world and never be hosted in the third world? And my response to that is, well, development conditions change over time, so maybe there would be some modification. But basically, yes, that's what I would recommend, that it hurts world soccer when you hurt individual countries in the third world by foisting the hosting upon them. You have dictatorships and corrupt governments that are opting to do this. It's not in the best interest of their people. It's economically very wasteful, if not devastating, to do it. And the notion that you have to spread it around the world and give it to different, so the people in South America can enjoy the World Cup, they can see it in person, or the people in Africa can enjoy the World Cup because now it was in South Africa, or even now that it's in Qatar, it's easier to get to Qatar from various countries in Africa. Why do we need to spread it around in an age when we have international jet travel and we have international telecommunications? When the World Cup was started in 1930 in Uruguay, that was the first host, we didn't have international jet travel and we didn't have international telecommunications. And the idea was that you actually did have to move it around to different countries around the world so people could experience it around the world. Who gets to experience the World Cup when you put the games in somebody's country? Well, if you're soccer crazy and you have enough money to buy tickets, then you get to directly benefit from having the stadium there and the game there, and you can watch the game live. But if you don't have those conditions, you don't get directly to benefit. And so the whole notion that FIFA owns this good, that they can give to a country and have the country become a stronger and better country because they're hosting the games, that's wrong. If it were true, then I would agree with you 100%. Let's make sure that all of the continents get to host the World Cup. But it's not true. The opposite seems to be true. And hence, it's not a benefit. It was not a benefit to South Africa. And it would not be a benefit to Argentina to get the games back again, and on and on. So I think you're pointing to very valid tensions. And it would be nice to have a system where everything was beneficial all the time to everybody. But we have to make some choices.
Will countries, our countries, you mentioned a couple of bid committees that have withdrawn their bids and taken themselves out of the running for the Winter and Summer Olympics. With some of these high publicity events, and there was supposedly tremendous spending in Sochi too, when Russia hosted the games, are countries from now on just going to be more careful about this stuff? Yeah, you know, natural gas rich Kazakhs are going to try to dip their toe in the water on this thing. I'm not sure how easy it is to get to Kazakhstan from everywhere else, but they're going to bid on some of these things. But in the main, are we looking at people just being more careful about this because we've learned a lesson about the downside risk?
Well, certainly one would hope that the lesson spreads far and wide. The problem seems to be that there are authoritarian countries out there with authoritarian leaders who like the personal exposure they get from being on the world stage, authoritarian leaders who themselves might have investments in or certainly have close contacts and friends who are in the construction industry. And the construction industry, of course, always wants their city or country to host the games. The more money they spend, the more contracts there are. And there will be some affiliated interests connected to investment banking, people who float the loans to borrow the money to pay for the games, some lawyers who work for the affiliated company. There'll be a coalition of people who are well connected to the authoritarian leaders and push these things, and they'll continue to go after them. And that can also happen, and it does happen in nominally democratic countries. But it's more likely to happen, especially when you have the tremendous imbalance of costs and revenues as you have in Qatar, it's more likely to happen in authoritarian countries.
Andrew Zimbalist is an economist who watches the world of sports and plants his flag at Smith College in the beautiful Connecticut River Valley in Massachusetts. Great to talk to you.
Ray, wonderful to talk to you as always.
You've been listening to On Shifting Ground, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or by making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there any other international stories you'd like us to be covering? Please send an email or voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Matteo Schimpf and Andrew Stelzer. Research and fact-checking were provided by Elise Manoukian. Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. KQED's Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. By the time you're listening to this, who knows? Maybe the U.S. just beat the Netherlands. Or maybe not. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.